This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday AM. I'm Sally Sara. Coming up, Australia's treatment of asylum seeker children is under scrutiny after the Bilawila family's youngest daughter was medevaced from Christmas Island.
There's a long-term psychological price for children who have essentially been subject to abusive and traumatising environments.
And the mouse plague in New South Wales, what will it take to end the infestation?
There are concerns that it could get worse before it gets better if mice continue to survive through winter. Mouse plagues tend to end in disease, and so when they do disappear, it's almost overnight. But there are markers to look out for, and unfortunately, there haven't been any of those just yet.
But first...
Stop! Oh, please, stop!
This week, police in Australia and across the world pulled off something unusual.
The biggest criminal sting ever in the Southern Hemisphere involving alleged mafia, bikie and global gangs.
Arrests in every capital city and 18 countries around the world after a three-year police sting which tricked nearly every level of the underworld.
It really was an audacious plot that police say was hatched over a couple of beers between the AFP and the FBI.
We have been in the back pockets of organised crime and operationalised a criminal takedown like we have never seen.
Hundreds of people have so far been arrested and more than 32 tonnes of drugs seized globally after criminals were tricked into sending millions of messages through an encrypted app, which was actually run by the FBI.
I've been at this for, almost 45 years, and I have never seen anything of this magnitude and creativity as well. It is that rare moment where police, they're actually in front of the crooks rather than playing catch-up, which is what makes this so extraordinary.
Duncan McNabb is a journalist, former police officer and private investigator.
We're talking about transnational crime groups, people like the Mafia, and outlaw motorcycle gangs, triads and so on, the most serious caste members of transnational crime, and the police are listening in on their very planning, which is exceptional stuff.
Let's go back and break down some parts of this story. Yep. So firstly, this centres around an app that was developed in the United States that US law enforcement got hold of this app, were able to help distribute it, and then were able to listen in real time. Tell us a bit about that.
The planning for this started when the FBI in Southern California arrested a bloke called Vincent Ramos, a Canadian chap, nice family man with a couple of kids, working quietly into IT. But he developed something called the Phantom Secure Phone, which is basically a stripped-down BlackBerry, highly secure, he believed impenetrable, and he was leasing it to various criminal contacts around the world. And this, he assured them, meant they could speak with complete confidence to other members who had the same phone. However, that wasn't quite as secure as he thought. The FBI eventually arrested him, which, if nothing else, created a massive void in the communications between these organisations. So up came another bloke who was developing his own very secure communications form. He thought, terrific, I've got an opportunity to fill the void. Unfortunately, the FBI also caught him around about the same time. So what the FBI did, they made him an offer he couldn't refuse in return for the possibility of reduced sentences and around about $120,000 for his services and $60,000 for expenses. He decided that he would turn his creation over to the FBI, which is this ANOM, A-N-O-M app. The bottom line is that any conversations or messages they have simply BCCs, like an email, the FBI.
So this app, ANOM, it was really taken over by the FBI. They were able to observe and listen in real time to what criminals were doing. But what kind of role was there with Australian Connections in spreading the distribution of this app to get it in the hands of more criminals? I understand a man called Hakan Ayak was heavily involved in that. In what way?
Yeah, he was. I think the police identified him fairly early on as a key player in the international market, they believed. And just the background, Ayak was born in Turkey, lived in Australia, I think went to James Cook High School in Sydney for a while. He left the country in about 2010 because the police were hot on his trail for a series of major drug trafficking operations. He hasn't set foot in Australia since. IAC was recognised as being a drug kingpin, and it's through these trusted network of people that IAC has finally got hold of an Anom phone. And I suppose bottom line, he said to all his mates in the underworld, he said, I've got this great phone, it's secure, we can chat. Without realising, of course, that all those conversations were also being recorded by the FBI and the AFP. So he was identified as that sort of the kingpin who, and an influencer who could persuade his criminal colleagues to use the same method of communication. And that's why it spreads so fast, and that's why there is a very strong Australian connection to it.
So give us a sense of the scale of the crimes and number of suspects that have been identified as a result of these operations. We're talking hundreds, aren't we?
We're talking, I think initially they were looking at around about 800 or so people globally, and literally globally, and a couple of hundred in Australia. We're looking at criminals in Mexico, in Southern California, in Australia, in New Zealand. There have been a lot of recent arrests in the last couple of days. Criminals throughout Europe, Rotterdam and the Netherlands, which is a massive transshipment port for drugs. All of these places are now focus of the investigations. All of these places are now seeing massive arrests. The bad guys are falling very, very fast, a bit like dominoes collapsing, frankly. It's a great, great piece of police work.
Just how important has Australia's role been in this? We had a press conference during the week from the FBI singling out the Australians and giving thanks to them. Just how important has the Australian role been?
We were originally selected as the test bed, I suppose, to see how good this app is. And what they found very, very quickly was as good as they thought. So the AFP were involved in actually listening in on the conversations in the Australian market. They can work out who the key players in the gangs, not only the gang members themselves, but also the affiliates who hang around them, people like money launderers. Through this app, they can work out who the cast of the gang is, which is, on an intelligence basis, is absolutely exceptional. And I suppose what it also tells us is how significant the Australian players are in global international crime, which is why we were selected as a test case.
Can you give us a bit of perspective on that as to where Australia sits with the scale of organised crime here and the size of the drug market for comparatively a small country?
It's invariably been driven by the drug market because we have, I think, among the highest per capita use of amphetamines and cocaine in the world. Oddity, we've also been the biggest coke users since the 1930s. We bat above our weight, which makes us a highly desirable business. We're also a great transshipment port as well because we have such massive sea borders, for example, so you can bring cocaine in readily, easily, or methamphetamine, and transfer it onto somewhere else. I think we'll always be this highly desirable market. We also have well-structured criminal enterprises here that developed in the 70s and 80s. The Mafia and the outlaw motorcycle gangs are perfect examples. So the logistics management is also first rate. So we'll always be, I think, a linchpin of the international drug market. We just make so much money for them.
What do you think this will mean for the structure and the survivability of these gangs now if big players have been taken out?
Crime is one of those things where the cliche nature abhors a vacuum is very accurate. We still have, particularly in drugs, this huge demand in Australia and globally. Crime will bat on. Someone will try and fill the void. In the pragmatic world of crime, they'll think, well, if XYZ have been removed, then someone sees an opportunity and they'll move in. Someone no doubt will pop up saying, I also have an impenetrable app as well, which is great news for them, but see how good it is.
Is this a trick that police can only do once, or will they be able to do it again with a different platform?
I think they'll be able to do it again, but the gangsters will learn by this. I mean, maybe in the interim, they'll go back to that quaint old-fashioned method we used to have of crooks gathering in pubs and whispering quietly in each other's ears. But yes, there will be other communications devices formed. This is a massive global business. It's not going to stop, but this is going to slow it down for a while.
Now that there has been a shake-up and some people have recommended this device and this app to others, are we expecting some reprisals and paybacks for what's happened?
I think the first thing they'll do is try and recoup their business. That's the first priority. But if I were people like Hakim Ayik, the Australian currently hiding out overseas, I'd be a bit apprehensive because these blokes also will be thinking about a bit of payback. Money first, payback second, I think. But I'd be feeling very uneasy. The AFP rather cheekily suggested the safest place he would be is back in Australia in custody. And I suspect they might be right.
What do you think are the lessons from this whole exercise for global policing? If these criminal networks are international, how good is law enforcement in acting on an international scale?
The problem with law enforcement for years has been we've always been a bit nationally focused. The old joke was if police stopped at the borders, criminals didn't. This is a remarkable turnaround. It shows how we can act globally with precision and get magnificent results. This is cooperation at its absolute best. Bring on more of it and it'll start making the criminals start to think whether they really want to be part of a gang.
Former police officer and journalist Duncan McNabb. This week, a photo of a toddler crying in a hospital bed went viral. The girl was 4-year-old Tanaka Muruguppan, the youngest daughter of the Bilawila family in detention on Christmas Island, and it reignited public concern over Australia's treatment of children in detention.
Really disturbing news from Western Australia involving the Tamil family who are being detained on Christmas Island. Their youngest daughter, Tanaka, has been medically evacuated to Perth after being hospitalised with a suspected blood infection.
The treatment has been absolutely disgraceful and depraved.
How does a child go from being unwell, feverish, to septicemia in Australia's care?
Is it ever okay to lock up two loving parents and their little girls just to keep aligned with our tough borders rhetoric?
It's not a case of being mean. We are very strong as a government in our policy in relation to our border protection.
Tanaka's Sri Lankan parents, Andes and Priya, came to Australia separately by boat almost a decade ago, then settled and had two girls in the small Queensland town of Bilawila. They were detained after their visas expired in 2018, then flown to Christmas Island, where they've been kept ever since as they fight the government's efforts to deport them. The government says they are not refugees and don't have the right to protection in Australia, but the pressure to free them is mounting. Louise Newman is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Melbourne who's worked across Australian detention centres.
It appears that this child has been unwell for around a 10-day period. The family were concerned about her. She was said to have some gastro symptoms. It was noted to be lethargic and generally unwell. She was taken and seen by local clinical services. We hear that she was told that antibiotics were not necessary, and I think the idea was to hope that the condition would resolve. But she progressively deteriorated up until the point where a decision was clearly made that she needed to go to a hospital. Christmas Island does not have paediatric facilities. It does not have facilities capable of managing a very sick child who might need intravenous medication or even other forms of support, such as respiratory support. And this child is felt to have had pneumonia and a possible septicemia, which is actually a very serious condition and needs fairly urgent treatment. So clearly a very anxiety-provoking situation for a very stressed family who have actually been in detention on the island since 2019.
What do we know about the living conditions for this family, particularly for the children on Christmas Island?
The issue for this family is really one of isolation. This is a family who are essentially under very high levels of security. If they go for a walk outside, or if the children are attending any activities or school, as they sometimes do, there's one guard per person, and a sense of obvious isolation, being so far away with limited communication and very limited activities. For children specifically, there are very, very little in the way of child-focused activities, let alone educational activities. The local school has always been very supportive of the asylum seeker and refugee families. But this remains a situation of essentially neglect And it's very much something that will have a potential negative impact on child development. And this has been, you know, the subject of a lot of research that a group of us have been involved in now, looking at some of the child outcomes for 15 plus years. And I think the terrible tragedy of this situation is that government is fully informed about the findings of this research. They cannot claim that they are ignorant, that there is damage being done, particularly to children, when we hold them in seemingly endless detention for reasons that are very unclear.
I wanted to ask you more about that research. With your understanding of child development and child psychology, what are the main concerns?
A lot of the concerns relate to the breakdown of parenting when parents are stressed and depressed, in combination with harsh and depriving environments. They are conditions where, over the years, many children have been exposed to a huge amount of trauma in adults. I've assessed children who have witnessed suicidal behaviour in people around them. There's a long-term psychological price for children who have essentially been subject to abusive and traumatising environments. These children are more likely to have long-term issues with depression, with anxiety, difficulties with relationships, and a breakdown of their capacity to have a normal life and trusting others. So these are very serious long-term effects. We've recently seen the outbreak of so-called resignation syndrome on Nauru amongst children and young adolescents there who are at the end of their capacity to manage that traumatising environment. Many of those children had to be medevaced to the mainland, where they were in a state of being semi-comatose and extremely unwell, not eating or drinking. And yet again, we seem to be replicating situations of extreme trauma. It's a frustrating situation where there's a seeming lack of ability to really come to terms with and account for the fact that children should not be in these circumstances, that they don't have the capacity to tolerate it, and we need to look for alternatives. And it's deeply troubling that we're hearing some of the rather tired old rhetoric from government currently about and attempts at justifying these very poor outcomes in children, including this three-year-old, on the grounds that it will deter others and somehow we don't want to set a precedent or we'll be overrun. It's an absurd argument. It's morally bankrupt. And I don't think it's one that can be maintained.
This family have been found several times not to be classified as refugees. Those people who support the government's point of view would say, look, the numbers of people arriving by boats has dropped off dramatically because of this hardline approach. If you're looking at the numbers, does the government have evidence for its approach that if it goes hard, the number of people arriving by boats stops?
I think there probably is some impact, clearly. In the current climate, I think it's difficult to estimate how much of very low numbers of people coming currently are due to other international factors, particularly COVID, as opposed to any Australian
but
policy.
But even prior to COVID, numbers had dropped down.
Yes, they had. And some of that, I think, is that we have actually managed, as Australia can do and can afford to do, we have managed to maintain numbers of humanitarian entrants and a certain number of visas for people with legitimate claims. The other issue, of course, is that Australia is now internationally known as an unwelcoming country. But that still doesn't justify, in my view, harsh treatment as a form of deterrence. This family are in the very unfortunate position of having to have the legal argument, which is obviously a complex one, about the rights of the child born in Australia to be properly assessed as having a claim for refugee status. It would obviously be preferable if that could be resolved as quickly as possible. This family remain in a limbo situation, which for anyone emotionally and psychologically is very difficult to sustain.
What have you thought about the public reaction to all of this?
I think what's pleasing is that I think there is a mood within the Australian community, and not only people who would define themselves as advocates, to address the needs of children and vulnerable people within our community in a much more positive way. And children and the maltreatment of children at the hands of government is becoming less tolerated. I think in the past, in my experience, we've had a bit of a collective blindness to the reality, the damage that we have done to asylum seeker children. But maybe in the current climate, it's less palatable and more people are prepared as general members of the community to actually say we don't need to do this and we don't want to do it or be responsible for it. Government then finds itself, as clearly is happening currently, in this very difficult position on the one hand of wanting to maintain a rather frightening and inaccurate rhetoric that this is somehow necessary, that harm to children is somehow necessary to prevent people actually arriving, and their need to better respond in a compassionate way to the needs of vulnerable people. I've yet to hear any reasonable justification for the ongoing detention of this family or these children when the alternatives are not available overseas, and nor should they be. The alternative is their rejoining a community who welcome them.
That's Louise Newman, Professor of Child Psychiatry. Well, for more than 6 months, regional New South Wales has been in the grip of a mouse plague of biblical proportions. Rural communities have thrown everything at trying to contain the damage.
Just over it. Like everyone else, just the smell, the stench, you never get used to it.
But there are estimates the mouse plague will knock $1 billion off the value of the state's winter crop, and many farmers are at breaking point.
Obviously, a lot of us live off rainwater, so the fact that we've got mice in our rainwater tanks has been, you know, bloody horrible, frankly. You're one source of water on a property and you've got mice in it.
And although temperatures have dropped, the crisis is a long way from over.
As you drive at night, it's like a carpet. It's just swarming with mice, and I've described it as kind of like bubble wrap, just that pop, pop, pop as you drive over. They're crawling over people while they're trying to sleep at night. I've heard of people whose babies have actually been bitten and scratched. Mums that go in to pick up their babies after asleep in their cot, and there's mouse poo around them. It's just numbers that you can't comprehend.
Lucy Thackray is an ABC rural reporter based in Dubbo. She's been reporting on the rodent crisis for the past 6 months.
People are coming out of the worst drought in living memory, and there's so much debt there for so many of the farmers. There was one good season last year, which was when people tried to have hay and grain and fodder to put aside. And all of that drought recovery is just gone for people. People are now having to set fire to hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of hay. And that's something that you couldn't believe that they're doing now, because during the drought, people were trying to get hay from wherever they could. It was so scarce. And the mice are also doing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars worth of damage to cars. They're eating engines, they're eating through walls in people's homes. Supermarkets and cafes are having to throw out tens of thousands of dollars worth of food every week because mice are just getting into it, and it doesn't matter what they do, they just manage to get in through any small crevice.
Lucy, what's the psychological toll been, especially for people on the land when, as you're saying, they were hanging out for this good season, they were desperate for hay, for fodder, for grain, and now some of them are having to burn that because the mouse problem is so bad. What's the toll of that?
I would definitely compare this to the last year of the drought. It has that impact where people can't escape it. You're living it. So you go to bed at night and they're through your bed. People go to the kitchen and it's through their food. They go to cook and there's mouse poo in their saucepans. They're having to deal with, you know, killing thousands of mice. And it's difficult because a lot of the best traps actually catch live mice. And this isn't a situation that anybody would want to be in. And to be dealing with that takes its toll because it's every single day. I spoke to Anne Cullen, who's a farmer in Canamble, about the fact that people are just needing to draw on more money from the bank to take bigger loans to try to get themselves out of this situation.
It's stressful. We've been trying to get some support for months. The latest support that's been announced is 8 months too late for us. And I've spent over $40,000 with buying the mouse bait, the aerial spreading, because we can't afford it. The price of spray, fuel, everything just keeps going up. And, you know, it's just another cost.
Anne's definitely not alone, and it's not just a problem for farmers. I spoke to the Brennans, who own a bakery in Narromine, and they say they don't know if they will be open by the end of the year because they are suffering so much financially because people don't want to go into their business when they see mice running around and buy food.
They don't realise that it's a domino effect.
Yeah, if the farmers can't spend.
If the farmers don't have money to spend, all the businesses, clothing businesses, food businesses in town, everybody suffers.
So what needs to happen in terms of the weather and the season and other factors to bring the plague to an end?
Fortunately, this week in New South Wales, there's been snow and a lot of rain, which would hopefully mean that you would see less around properties, but it can also drive them into homes because although lots of people were hoping that maybe rain or cold weather would kill off mice, the experts are telling us that actually it's disease that ends mouse plagues and that they end quite quickly. So what you would probably see with rain or with colder weather is that there are less running around, and people had reported seeing less over the last month or so. And so they were quite hopeful and they sowed their winter crops. But then as soon as they sowed it and that crop germinated, already there has been total crop losses for some people because even if you haven't seen them, they come out of their burrows as soon as there's food around and just scavenge, and there are new mouse holes through crops. There are whole leaves off the top of newly germinated crops, which means that that plant has now died. So that's more expense. And people have been baiting those crops, and it's just not doing anything because there's so much food around at the moment that a lot of those baits just seem to not be able to do the job as compared to a delicious new crop.
And from a farmer's perspective, the worst case scenario would be that the mice survive the winter and they're then around as harvest comes. Is that right?
Yeah, and the worry is if mice survive through winter, they actually have continued to breed up until the end of May, and some are still breeding, and normally they would have stopped in November last year. But if they continue to breed through winter or even just survive in spring when they will start to breed again, they will be starting from an even higher base than last year. And so that means that the plague would continue into next year, but also be even worse. We'd see even higher numbers.
What are farmers doing trying to control the mouse, and what kind of assistance are they receiving from government, especially in New South Wales?
At the moment, the recommendation for farmers is that they use zinc phosphide. And so what happens is they take wheat and other grain and they apply the poison to that grain so that it becomes a bait, and then that's scattered around the crop. And that is recommended because there is very low to no secondary killing rate, meaning if other animals then eat mice that have been baited, it's not expected that they would then die. Experts at the moment are looking at a double-strength zinc phosphide. There are hopes that with that double-strength zinc phosphide, there should be even more success for farmers. The other option at the moment which is being considered is bromodialone, which is quite a contentious poison because it has a higher secondary rate of killing. And there have been a lot of concerns from farmers, from environmentalists, from fishers who are concerned because we now know that fish are eating mice as well, who are concerned that there could be huge impacts to the environment.
Is there end in sight, do you think, Lucy?
There are concerns that it could get worse before it gets better if mice continue to survive through winter. Mouse plagues tend to end in disease, and so when they do disappear, it's almost overnight. Experts say that they often get calls from farmers saying, my mice were here yesterday and now they've completely disappeared. Where have they gone? But there are markers to look out for, and unfortunately there haven't been any of those just yet.
Well, I remember as a kid growing up during the mouse plague in rural South Australia in the early 1980s, and when you're in the middle of it, it does feel like it will never end. Our thoughts are with those people who are battling it at the moment. And Lucy Thackray, thank you so much for your coverage.
Thank you.
That's ABC rural reporter in Dubbo, Lucy Thackray. That's Saturday AM for this week. You can subscribe to our podcast or find us on the ABC Listen app. I'm Sally Sara. Have a good weekend. Thank you.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.